For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I'm Joey. This is my wife, Lauren. We've been married for about 6 years, so we're experts on being married for 5 years. No longer than that, really. But we wanted to put some stuff together for people who are pretty newly married and people who are engaged, just to give you some stuff to think about. So why don't we pray really quick, and then we'll get started. Well, Lord, thanks for this conference. Thanks for how many great speakers we've had today. Thanks for all the people who have shared all this content with us. We just pray that you'd open our minds here about all the stuff that we can start implementing into our marriages and that really set us up for a lifetime of success together. Yeah. All right. Amen. Well, talking about early marriage. Marriage is all about pursuing oneness. If you've taken premarital counseling or you've looked at a bunch of marriage books already, you probably realize that God has made the two to become one flesh. And we spend our life as husband and wife trying to live this out. We can also understand that marriages thrive on many of the same principles that make the body of Christ thrive. When we talk about unity and being linked together spiritually and all the one another passages, these same things apply to a healthy marriage as apply to our healthy friendships. We can understand as well that sacrificial love is going to be the thing through our lifetime together that propels intimacy and closeness as time goes on, rather than just romantic feelings. Now, Lauren and I certainly believed all that when we got married and really took that seriously. And the first couple years of our marriage went really smoothly. We didn't really have a whole lot of problems. Things were really good. And then a couple of years ago, we encountered some circumstances that were really difficult. They were outside of our control and really outside of our marriage, but they still had they took a pretty big emotional toll. And that led to some different sorts of challenges that we'd never really faced before. And it made us rethink some of our approaches and some of the strategies we were using to really make sure we were in sync with one another. And as we started to look into these things, we wondered, why haven't we been doing this all along? Why didn't we start this when we first got married? So the question that we really want to answer today is, what does it look like to build these positive habits into our marriage? What are very simple things we can do early on that really set us up for all these principles of sacrificial love and giving out to one another in that way so that we can have intimacy and closeness in the long term in our marriage? So Lauren's going to talk first, and she's going to speak to trust and commitment and respect.
All right. Yeah, so I'm going to kick us off talking about commitment. And this is a quote from a researcher named John Gottman, which is where we got the majority of our material. He is a researcher. He's been researching marriage for 40 years. And what I really like about him is that he gives practical day-to-day things on how to build these positive habits into your marriage. So here's what he has to say about commitment. In a relationship, commitment is a choice we make every single day, over and over again. We choose it even when we are tired and overworked and stressed out. We choose it no matter what attractive person crosses our path. We choose it every time our partner makes a bid for attention and we put down our book, look away from the TV or up from the smartphone, or stop whatever it is we're occupied with to acknowledge their importance in our life. True commitment is choosing each other over and over again, because ultimately what makes relationships work is the decision to make them work. I really like his definition here, because it's highlighting that a commitment to our spouse is really a day-to-day commitment, that I have decided to make it work with this person, really no matter what. And really all marriages start with a pledge of commitment, right? Till death do us part, in sickness and in health. But the problem is, when we look out on our culture, what do we see? A really lame version of commitment, right? A high divorce rate. People are not even getting married. We're seeing that a lot with younger people. They're waiting longer and longer to get married because they're cynical about this idea of commitment. We're seeing people get divorced for reasons like, well, we just grew apart. We fell out of love. I felt like I was living with a stranger. We just don't really know each other anymore, right? So to really get a basis for commitment, we're going to have to look elsewhere. And really, commitment should make the most sense to people who are radically following Christ, because God is really our foundation for what commitment looks like. Look at this verse in 1 John 4:10 through 11. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. So our foundation and our example and model to commit to our spouse is coming straight from Christ. God sent down his son not only to save us, but God has also sealed us with his Holy Spirit permanently. That's incredible. That's God saying to us, I'm completely committed to you. And this is really where we're getting our cues to give this over to our spouse. Notice that it doesn't include a clause at the end here, like, you also ought to love one another and your spouse as long as they don't leave their crap everywhere in the house, right? No, this really is a choice to be committed to them on the day-to-day. And when this commitment's demonstrated, that's really what starts to build trust. So let's talk about trust a little bit. Trust is easily given in the early stages of a relationship. You start dating someone, you really like them, you have a crush on them, you tend to believe the things that they say are true about their life and their beliefs. You easily give them the benefit of the doubt. Plus, they're really hot, so that helps. But really, a relationship can't stay stagnant here. It can't just build off of these early moments in our relationship. It has to grow. And much like commitment, trust is demonstrated through acting on promises from the day to day. These are as big as, I promise to stay faithful to you emotionally and physically, right? That's a big promise that we can demonstrate to our spouse, all the way down to the little ones, like, hey, I told you this week I would get dinner with your parents, and I'm going to come through on that. And so the more and more we come through, we demonstrate to our spouse that I committed to you, you can trust me, and I'm dependable. And really what this is building is we're building closeness, intimacy, and vulnerability. That because you've demonstrated your dependability to me and vice versa, I can be more vulnerable with you. I feel safe doing that. My guard is down because this trust has been built. But Gottman gets into what really breaks down trust and commitment and respect. He calls these the four horsemen of the apocalypse of marriage. And it's not just that these four things, these are like the only dysfunctional things you can encounter in a marriage, but he says that the presence of these four things consistently in a marriage is very telling of whether or not a marriage is going to last or not. So I wanted to go through these four things. And really, you know, if you're just getting married, or especially if you're engaged, you might not see these things right away. So the purpose of going through these is that when you start to see these things creep in, as they will in probably every marriage, can kind of light a red flag for you. All right, criticism. So Gottman's first one, he says that criticism is very damaging in a marriage. But he distinguishes between a complaint versus a criticism. So let's look at two examples of this. Here's the complaint. This is a wife talking to her husband. I need you to check with me before inviting people over for dinner. I wanted to spend time alone with you tonight. I wanted to have a quality date night. Okay, so that's her complaint, her frustration that she's bringing to her spouse. Here's criticism. See if you can pick up on the difference. Why do you keep prioritizing your friends over me? I always come last on your list. Are you avoiding spending time with me? All right, so what's the differences between these two? The complaint is actually a fair way to bring something up. Why? She's keeping it within the situation. She's keeping it within the circumstance. In this situation, I wish you would have done this because I really wanted to spend time with you. Here's why. The criticism is like a full-on assault, and it's an overarching statement of her husband's character. You always prioritize your friends over me, not just here, always. And she's assigning motive to him. You're avoiding spending time with me. You just don't want to spend time with me. That must be it. So the problem with criticism is that we are critiquing our spouse and who they are. We're bringing judgment down on their character, and we're taking the conflict and blowing it up outside of the situation and the circumstance. And so when criticism starts to build in marriage, contempt usually comes next. Look at this situation Gottman talks about between a couple. Contempt's arrival is heralded when Dara literally sneers at her husband's suggestion that they keep a list of his chores on the refrigerator to help him remember. She says, "Do you think you work really well with lists?" Next, Oliver tells her that he needs 15 minutes to relax when he gets home before starting to do chores. So if I leave you alone for 15 minutes, then you think you'll be motivated to jump up and do something? Ouch, she asks him, still sneering. "Maybe, we haven't tried it, have we?" Oliver asks. Dara has an opportunity here to soften up, but instead she comes back with sarcasm. "I think you do a pretty good job of coming home and lying around or disappearing into the bathroom," she says. And then she adds challengingly, "So you think that's the cure-all to give you 15 minutes?" You can feel the disdain coming off of this quote. You're like, ooh, like you feel like you're coming into an awkward moment in their relationship, right? And we can see obvious problems with this. But how contempt really forms is when we have started to ruminate on something we greatly dislike about our spouse. And really, contempt is an arrogant evaluation of how our spouse has failed us over and over again. And this is poisonous because it communicates to your husband and your wife, "I greatly dislike who you are in this way." And you can see why this would start to break down trust. And so when these two come in, it's pretty natural for defensiveness to come in. Now, we're all going to get defensive at times in conflict, and I'm sure we're like this with our friends too. And defensiveness, really, it's a method we employ to shift the blame. So what this looks like is, you know, your spouse is about to bring some sort of criticism or maybe even a complaint to you, and you immediately start forming the defense in your mind while they're talking. You're like, oh, no, this is their fault. Here's why it's their fault. Here's how I'm going to come back at them after they stop talking about this to me. And so we're formulating our defense, right? We're getting ready to launch our attack on them. And there's really two problems with defensiveness. First of all, while you're formulating that defense in your mind, you are not listening at all to what your spouse is bringing to you. You're not able to really hear them out. And when we're not willing to let down the walls of defensiveness, we're not really able to resolve the conflict. And this is when this really starts to become insidious in marriage. Is when we don't come back together humbly and say, "I'm sorry, I was defensive there," and are able to really talk it out. Then we have stonewalling. And this is when one or both of the spouses has decided that it's just not even worth it to talk through this stuff anymore, and they just start to ignore their spouse altogether. And interestingly enough, in 85% of marriages, this is usually the husband who employs this four horsemen. And so this would look like husband walks in the door and the wife immediately starts maybe getting on him about cleaning or something like that. And he decides to completely shut her out, ignore her, walks over to the couch, turns on the TV, totally stonewalls her. Why would it get to here? Because you've decided that what my spouse has to say is not important to me. I get flooded constantly when they bring these things up. They don't listen, and so it's just not even worth it to engage. And so you see that when these four horsemen are present, a couple is getting more and more distant, and the connection between them is being lost. And really the problem and the common theme between all four of these is you're communicating a great lack of respect to your spouse, where you're communicating to them, it's like, "I don't care what you have to say or what you think, and I'm not really willing to humbly resolve this with you." And so I want to talk about how to maintain respect for one another, because we know that respect is often lost when we're allowing ourselves to dwell on these negative things about our spouse. But the thing is respect is something that is commanded of all of us in Scripture. Look at Ephesians 5:33. "However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband." Okay, so we're called as believers, as spouses, to respect each other, to put each other first. Notice that God is not saying here, you can choose to just throw off respect for your spouse whenever you want, or when you deem that they have done something too messed up. Right? No, this is something that we're commanded to continue to do. Which brings me to my next point. Respect is a choice. We can choose whether or not we respect our spouse. It's an attitude that we have towards them. This is not just something that's broken or lost. we're choosing whether or not we want to respect them. And so I thought it'd be useful to talk about, how do we put this into practice? How do we maintain respect for our spouse so that we don't see these four horsemen come in? Well, this one might seem pretty obvious, showing and practicing gratitude. But I think when you live with someone every day, you have day-to-day interactions, it becomes pretty easy just to kind of coast in the relationship and not really be thinking about how can I be regularly building my spouse up. And this is what Gottman says here, too. He says, sometimes couples resist searching for and expressing gratitude for their spouse's positive behavior because they tell me doing so feels phony to them. But developing a positive habit doesn't sugarcoat a relationship. Instead, it resets it to a more realistic perspective. Just knowing this can make all the difference for couples who are feeling pessimistic about their partner in marriage. Research by Elizabeth Robinson and Gail Price brings home this happy truth. They had objective, trained observers count how many positive acts they witnessed between a couple during the course of an evening. Then, they asked the spouses themselves to tally their positive interactions. They discovered that couples who described themselves as unhappily married only noticed half of the positive interactions that actually occurred. Because they were so used to tuning into their partner's mistakes, they each missed a full 50% of their partner's positive actions. So what this research is demonstrating is that when we are focused on the negative, we are missing half of the positive things going on in our marriage. So much of this is an attitude. And what is going to really be the cure-all for this in a lot of ways is by expressing appreciation for our spouse on a regular basis. This could be something small, like, hey, thank you so much for handling the bills every month. That actually takes like a huge burden off my shoulders. Really appreciate that. All the way to, man, you're so good at like talking me through things and drawing me out, and I so appreciate that, that you help me process what's going on in my head. And we're getting into the habit of, when we're seeing a positive thing in our spouse, we're expressing appreciation for that, big to small. All right, the next one is fondness and admiration, maintaining this with our spouse. And actually, Gottman says that a marker for this is if we can recall our history with our spouse fondly. Look at this quote. The best test of whether a couple still have a functioning fondness and admiration system is usually how they view their past. If a marriage is troubled, asking the couple about the current state of affairs is not likely to elicit mutual praise. But query them about the past, and you can often detect embers of positive feelings. Gottman says that there will be couples that come in for counseling where they are on the verge of divorce. But when they start talking about how they fell in love and when they first met, they light up. And he says oftentimes these are the marriages that will survive because they still can look back at their past fondly. They still have fondness and admiration for their spouse. And so we have to maintain a friendship with our spouse and remember why I really like my spouse and the good things that they have brought into my life. A lot of times when we first meet our spouse, we're attracted to certain qualities about them. Say that your spouse is really spontaneous and you're a more kind of rigid routine person, so you love that your spouse gets you to go be adventurous and do fun things that you wouldn't have normally done. Then you get married and you realize something about your spouse. They don't want to do anything that's not exciting, like handle any of the bills and help you with functional tasks. And so you have a choice here. Am I going to focus on that aspect of their personality, the weakness, or am I going to remember that strength that I love so much? And that's really what this is about, is it's remembering what we love about them, expressing appreciation about it. And I think a big part of this too that I forgot to mention with the last one is we need to incorporate this in our prayer time too. That when we're talking to God and praying about our marriages, thanking God for the biggest blessing besides salvation in our lives, which is our spouse. That he has given me a person to live my life with, a partnership, and why I love them so much. And expressing to God gratitude for them. This can completely change your attitude and change your mind about your spouse. So I think that's one of the main ways that we can be maintaining respect. And Joey's going to take this third one here, turning toward one another.
Yeah. Another thing that Gottman talks about is turning toward one another. And one really simple way that he gets into this is by responding to each other's bids. So here's what he says about this. He says, romance is kept alive. Now, when he says romance, he's a secular researcher. He's maybe using that term more broadly than we might. A better word might be something like intimacy. But that it's kept alive each time you let your spouse know he or she is valued during the grind of everyday life. In marriage, couples are always making what I call bids for each other's attention, affection, humor, or support. Bids can be as minor as asking for a back rub or as significant as seeking help and carrying the burden when an aging parent is ill. So the partner responds to each bid by turning toward the spouse or turning away. And a tendency to turn toward your partner is the basis of trust, emotional connection, passion, and a satisfying sex life. So what is this? These are so important because it keeps us from tuning each other out. This is basically communicating that when my spouse initiates with me, I'm going to listen. I'm going to respond. I'm going to show respect for what she's saying or what he's saying, and I'm going to do it consistently. That's really what this is all about. It's giving a proportional response to our spouse's initiation into our lives and showing them that I care about what you have to say, and I respect what you say, and I'm going to listen to you and respond to you. These don't need to be over the top, okay? So something really simple would be if your spouse says, oh man, I think I overcooked the chicken. You don't need to say like, oh, poor baby, I still love you so much. And our wedding vows when I said I'd always be there for you, I really meant that, and I mean it now more than ever, you know? It doesn't need to be like that. Something as simple as like, yeah, the oven's pretty funky, that's all right. I bet it'll still be good. How could this matter? Why does this really make that much of a difference? This seems so small and insignificant. Well, Gottman says that in a 6-year follow-up of newlyweds, we found that couples who remained married had turned toward their partner's bids an average of 86% of the time. Those who got divorced, only 33%. We're getting into the habit of giving each other our attention and showing that what you say matters to me. What I want to listen to you. And so when we do it in these smaller ways, Gottman says that's like putting money in a bank account. It's like we are storing up a certain number of positive interactions and respectful interactions that when something more substantial or difficult comes in, now we're just used to giving each other attention and respect. We're used to responding to one another and tuning in rather than tuning out. Okay? And all these things are really important because they greatly influence the ways that we manage conflict. A lot of us are so worried about conflict when we first get married and early on. We're so worried about fighting. That's the main thing that we're worried about sometimes is all the fighting. What if we fight? How's that going to be? Whatever. Here's what Gottman says about this. Only 40% of the time do couples divorce because they're having frequent, devastating fights. So the big fights, the devastating fights, those do have an impact. And if we're running into that, yeah, we do need some help. We do need some outside counsel potentially. But more often marriages end because to avoid constant skirmishes, husband and wife distance themselves so much that their friendship and sense of connection are lost. This is really the bigger threat to marriage, is withdrawing from one another, not dealing with our conflicts, not showing each other respect like this, like we're talking about. Gottman talks about two different types of problems that cause conflict in marriage, perpetual problems and solvable problems. Solvable problems are more like circumstantial issues. Sometimes they're temporary, they're related to a problem that we're running into, and so the compromises are a little bit simpler, the solutions are a little bit easier to see if we're both humble enough to admit to them and agree to them. Perpetual problems really come down to more like personal differences. You're different from your spouse, so you're going to see certain things differently. You're going to be affected by certain things differently, and that's going to cause friction at different times. The issue here is that with perpetual problems, compromises aren't always clear, and they're not even always fair, because asking your spouse to compromise on a perpetual problem might be asking them to just be a different person. And that's not fair. That's why these cause so many problems. And it's hard to find examples of these because it can be different depending on the couple. So if you're married to someone who's always late, and that doesn't really bother you, but then they are late to something that was really important, and you're like, I needed you to be there on time for that. That'd be a solvable problem for that couple. But if you grew up in a home where punctuality was considered very respectful and being late was really disrespectful, and so every time your spouse is late, you think they're disrespecting you, disregarding your feelings, that'd be more of a perpetual problem, even though it's the same issue. So it kind of depends. The main thing to understand is that the main goal of conflict is mutual understanding. That's not the only goal with conflict necessarily, but that's the main goal, regardless of what type of problem is causing the conflict, all right? 70% of the conflict in marriage is related to perpetual problems, these personal differences, the ways that this affects you versus the way it affects me, the way we're looking at this thing, why this thing is important to you and it's not as important to me, or whatever it is. That's going to be where most of our conflict comes from. So the emphasis needs to be on solving the solvable problems as they come up. So when it comes to understanding on a solvable problem, we need to understand each other's perspective on that problem so that we have enough humility and we've demonstrated enough respect for each other's feelings about the matter or the situation that we can come to a compromise. We can come to some sort of agreement or some way to accommodate that problem in the future. But perpetual problems, yeah, they're going to cause friction, but they also present a greater opportunity for us to understand our spouse at a deeper level. Yeah, okay, I don't care about this thing as much, but my spouse does. Why is that? Let's have a discussion about that. So we don't really need to be afraid of conflict as long as we're solving the problems that can be solved by both being reasonable with one another, okay? The main goal, though, is mutual understanding. Here's a good thing to remember from Gottman here. He says, after tracking the lives of happily married couples for as long as 20 years, I now know that the key to reviving or divorce-proofing a relationship is not simply how you handle your disagreements, but how you engage with each other when you're not fighting. It's so easy to overlook this. You talk to a lot of young couples, and the only real measurement they have for how well their marriage is going is like, well, we haven't had a fight in this long. And that's not really a good enough metric to measure your entire marriage. Frankly, you know, we could talk about conflict resolution resources all day long. There's tons of them out there. You can access so many of them. You can go find different things about communication and how to manage different types of conflict. But all these strategies that are out there usually fail people when they're not in the habit of practicing and showing respect to one another. The reason is that all these conflict resolution strategies that you can talk about only work when you are showing respect for each other. If we're not in the habit of respecting each other outside of conflict, it's really hard to just flick a switch and suddenly I respect you even though we're in a fight right now. So that's where the emphasis needs to be. We can figure out how to manage conflict as it comes up, but this is where we want to keep the emphasis, is on those things we talked about before. But we're still going to give some strategies anyway that'll be really helpful. All right? The first thing is to soften your startup. The startup is the way you begin a conversation about a disagreement. John Gottman noticed that by looking at a couple discuss an area they disagreed on for about 2 minutes, he not only could predict whether or not they were going to resolve that problem, but he also got really big insight as to whether or not their marriage was going to last. So this makes a pretty big difference. So we want to come in and acknowledge our responsibility. We want to share our feelings about the problem. Keep the focus on the specific situation and express what we need, not what we don't need. Essentially, we're not pointing the finger at our spouse's character. Instead, we're keeping it focused on what I feel, how I perceive the situation, and what I'd like to be different next time. Here's an example that Gottman gives. He's got a spouse coming in who says, hey, I know I can be a slob sometimes myself, but I'm really angry that you walked by the laundry basket last night without stopping to fold any sheets. I didn't like having to fold them all myself. The reason he names this as an example is because he says these soft startups do not need to be excessively diplomatic or overly gentle. I mean, this is a little bit on the nose coming from the spouse here. There's some emotional, like, oomph in there or whatever. But this spouse is still hitting all these areas. And so that's going to give the husband or the wife, whoever's talking, an easier chance to respond without getting into one of the four horsemen. That's what's so important about this, because a harsh startup is almost always going to lead to one of the four horsemen. We're going to get defensive. There's going to be more contempt being passed back and forth now. These soft startups do a lot to offset the criticism and contempt that might be building in our own minds. And that's why this is so important, because we're keeping the focus on a situation and my feelings about that situation without pointing the finger at our spouse and their character and their motives and all the ways they've failed us over the last however many years. We're just not even getting into that. That's what leads to unnecessary fighting in a relationship. Another thing is to notice and respond to one another's repair attempts. That's when a spouse looks to diffuse tension, okay? This signals emotional flooding, which is why stonewalling happens. Stonewalling is basically the flight portion of the fight or flight response. And so this is signaling that something about what we're talking about or the way we're talking about it, it's too much for me right now. We need to slow down or maybe rewind a little bit or maybe revisit this in a little while. And these can vary widely, which is why we need to be able to really perceive what our spouse is saying. It could be humor or inside jokes. It's actually a good sign if we can laugh in the midst of conflict, depending on what we're talking about. Could be a plea. I'm not talking about a needy plea that shuts the conversation down, but something like, hey, I really want to listen to you right now, but you're so upset that I don't know how to respond. Can we both cool down for a minute and revisit this in a few minutes? It could be appealing to a prior agreement. Like, I'm more than willing to talk about our finances, but we agreed we wouldn't just fly into these discussions and stress each other out. Let's take a few minutes, figure out what we really want to talk about, and then we'll reconvene and talk about it. Something like that. Okay? Here's what Gottman says about repair attempts. He says, in unhappy marriages, a feedback loop develops between the four horsemen and the failure of these repair attempts. The more contemptuous and defensive the couple are with each other, the more flooding occurs, the harder it is to hear and respond to a repair. And since the repair is not heard, the contempt and defensiveness just get heightened until finally one partner withdraws. Essentially, we're just allowing the tension between the couple to just continually be stretched until one person has to bow out because it's just too much. And then we can't reach a resolution. This happened to us a couple of weeks ago. We were in the middle of a disagreement. And at one point, Lauren paused and said, hey, is that a mosquito bite on your arm? That's actually a repair attempt, even though it sounds kind of silly. The problem was I didn't respond to it. I went, yeah, anyway, listen. And so it ended up drawing out the conversation for longer than it had to. So it's really important when we pause on these moments and say, okay, he's telling me that he needs a break. She's showing me that this is, I'm too upset or whatever. Listen out for these. It'll help you in conflict. But what if we do get into a fight? We think we're going to last our whole lifetime of a marriage together and never get in a single fight together. We're going to be disappointed in about, well, probably by the time we leave today. I don't know. So this is a really good couple of steps to follow. You would do these separately and then come back together and discuss it. We're revisiting a fight we had. How was I feeling at the time of the fight and what was my responsibility? What did I specifically contribute? And then what set me off? What was the moment when I went from being reasonable to unreasonable? So, you know, okay, I was feeling really alienated from you. I know I said I'd help you clean the house and I ended up not having time, but what set me off was when I heard you say the word lazy. That's when I really got upset. And then when we come together to discuss this, we want to acknowledge each other's position. This doesn't mean that we have to agree with what we're saying, but we want to acknowledge what we're saying. Because if we don't do that, this is how we end up talking about, well, you said this. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. And then we just end up doing that for however long we do it. So hear each other out. That's the point here. And then talk about what could we do differently. Talk about that. Yeah, I shouldn't be name calling. I could see how that caused a fight. I can see how that would have been hurtful. Next time I won't do that, even if I'm upset. I'll avoid that. So those are some ways to manage conflict. Part of why we would want to be practicing all these things is so that we become more competent to pursue God together. That's really what we want. We want to be able to contribute to one another's spiritual growth, to contribute to the mission of Christ, and we want to be able to do that together. And it turns out that this adds a lot of advantages to our marriage when we're actively engaged with those sorts of things. Here's what Gottman says, and this is a purely secular perspective. This is not a Christian book. But he says, it's also true that a rewarding marriage is about more than sidestepping conflict. the more you can agree about the fundamentals in life, the richer, more profound, and in a sense, easier your marriage is likely to be. A crucial goal of any marriage, therefore, is to create an atmosphere that encourages each person to talk honestly about his or her convictions. The more you speak candidly and respectfully with each other, the more likely there is to be a blending to your sense of meaning. He refers to this as creating shared meaning, creating a broader, bigger meaning for your marriage, okay? We can understand that dedicated followers of Christ would have major advantages in this area. Why is that? It's the word create. He's saying that non-Christian couples have to create this shared meaning. They have to create these shared values. They have to create these things that they can agree on and live their lives for. We're coming in as followers of Christ, having our values set by what God says, having the priorities of our life settled by what God calls us to be doing, and we've agreed on that and practiced that before we married one another. And so we've got this unity already. That's really similar to what it says in Philippians 2, like being of the same mind, same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. It's not that we're robotically just the same person all of a sudden, but that we agree on the things that matter most. And so when it comes to really pursuing God radically together as a married couple, we're actually setting ourselves up to have a much healthier marriage. Isolation, therefore, is a huge mistake. We don't want to wall off our marriage and build a fortress around our marriage. We want our marriage to extend outward to the body of Christ and to the people who don't know God. We should keep this in mind. If all the elements that go into participating in ministry were beneficial or helped us get prepared for marriage, like bearing other people's burdens, giving our time to other people, sacrificially pouring into other people, if all those things got us ready for marriage, why would we ever look at them as an encumbrance to our marriage after we got married? Suddenly all those people I was pouring into, that I learned so much about how to pour into my wife, suddenly they're in the way of me loving my wife or something like that? You should keep in mind Hebrews 10. We're not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. The point is, it's not just our presence during times of organized fellowship, but our contributions outward into the lives of other people. Frankly, there are plenty of non-Christian married couples where the husband and wife really, really love each other, and that love never goes outside of their home. That's just not what we're called to do as followers of Christ. The love that we're practicing between us is also extending out from beyond our home. Our home is open for people to be able to come in and be loved by us. We are going out, loving the people of God, sharing God with people who don't know Him. That's what we want our marriage to be all about. And so part of why we want our marriage to be really strong is so that we can continue to pursue these things radically once we get married. We also need to learn to seek counsel before we have a problem. A lot of couples wait too long. They're like, well, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about things, so whatever. Guess I'll check back in with these wise people in my life when I feel like things are really hitting the fan. Think about this for a second. John Gottman at his institute, he has two different types of workshops that he offered. One was preventative for younger couples, and the other was restorative for struggling marriages. A year out from these things, they checked back with these people and they found that the preventative workshops were 3 times more effective than the restorative ones. And by the way, the restorative workshops that he did, those were already 2x as effective as most restorative workshops and marriage counseling that people already offer. So it's highly effective to get counsel and input from the people around you and to have that door open in your marriage before there ever is a problem. It's easier to avoid some of these dysfunctional habits than it is to correct them after years have gone by and it's too late for you to have ever seen them coming. I'm not saying that your marriage won't recover or something like that. I'm saying it's way easier to have people speaking into that area before any of those things develop and you can have your eyes on them. Lauren's going to talk a little bit now about autonomy.
All right. I'm going to talk a little bit about avoiding autonomy because I'm really good at being autonomous, so I consider myself an expert in this area. This is probably the biggest weakness that I've had to work through in our marriage, and learning how to be a spouse who is willing to be interdependent. And so a few years back, me and Joey, after our first couple years of marriage was really like smooth sailing, a few years back we had a few situations happen within the same month that were really earth-shattering for us and caused a lot of emotional turmoil for both of us. And I had never really been through any sort of suffering like that before in my life. And so I had no idea how to deal with it. And so I employed some really healthy coping mechanisms. I stuffed it deep down inside, and I subconsciously decided I will not let this affect my life. And if you've ever tried to do that, you know that it doesn't work. So problems started to arise inside of our marriage, where Joey would try to be asking me about how I was feeling about things, what my thoughts were, and I was already just overwhelmed, didn't know how I was feeling, and trying to avoid those negative feelings, that I would either just end up shutting down or exploding and blowing up. And then I wasn't able at all to enter into his life, his hurt, what he was feeling about these things. And so really I was functioning through my life pretty independently. And after a handful of months of this, my sister noticed, she said, "So, seems like you haven't really dealt at all with these situations. Maybe you should go back to see your counselor that you've seen before." And I was like, probably a good idea. So I went back to my counselor, fully expecting we're going to work through some of these hard situations. I'm going to do some good processing. We should be good to go. And we did do that. But I was surprised and a little bit perplexed that she quickly started talking about my marriage and bringing my marriage into all of this and how this was affecting my marriage. And I remember one day she asked me a really interesting question. She said, "Lauren, do you know how these situations affect Joey?" And I looked at her and I said, "Who?" No, but actually, it was really funny. I really had not considered that. I was so overwhelmed myself that I had not really considered, how is Joey feeling about this stuff? How do these circumstances affect him? And so we worked on that a lot, where he would come in with me to counseling at times, and we kind of work on this, on how to actually be partners and how to let him be a part of my life and to include him in my life. For him to help me make decisions too. So I wanted to give you guys a few tips that I learned that were really helpful for me in this area. The first thing is to talk about what is going on in your head with your spouse. I, at times, have so many thoughts, and they seem so nebulous, and for me to verbalize them seems very overwhelming. So a lot of times he is just left out of what I'm actually thinking. And so I had to learn that when you talk about what's going on in your head, it's actually helpful. That's crazy. I never believed that before. When I started doing this, he understood me more. I felt really loved by it because he would help me think through and process my thoughts. And we had more of a mutual understanding of how each other were feeling about things. So this is really helpful. Next is talk with your spouse, even if you've talked with someone else. I am blessed with really close friendships I've had for a long time. And a lot of times when I have emotionally worked through things with them and talked with them, I would forget to like clue Joey in on that. And there'd be some times where he'd be like, "Lauren, I haven't even heard about that. Your close friends have heard about that, but I haven't." And that was a real wake-up call. So we should be talking with our spouse as much, probably more, than we are with our other close relationships. Our friendships are fantastic, and if you have those, that's great. But our spouse is our partner and the one who we're married to and that we are going through life with. Also, consult them. Consult your spouse on your day-to-day plans and decisions. I'm very independently minded, and so I have a routine. I have things that I want to get done, and nothing's getting in my way. I'm just moving forward. So I would rarely stop to consider, what's Joey's input on this thing? Or maybe I should tell him what I'm planning for my life. And so it's really good to ask your spouse, what do you think about this? Here's what I've been thinking about this decision that we have to make, and I want to make that together, which brings me to my next point. Think in terms of us, not me. It's about reframing your mindset. How are we going to live our lives? How are we going to handle this situation? What do we want to do together? How are we going to make this decision, right? So we are completely reorienting our perspective away from this life I'm living is all about me and the decisions that I make. And now I'm including this person and asking them to be a part of that. And sometimes this can be a bigger adjustment than we think. Also, this is all about letting your spouse influence you. I had a person in my life who said this is like letting someone put their fingers into your life, which is kind of like a creepy image, but it's like really helpful for me to think about. I'm letting someone else and what they think affect me and change my mind. I'm letting my spouse influence me. And what this is doing is it's creating interdependence, where we're relying on each other, where we're consulting each other, and we are a unit who do things together. Not codependent, where I have to consult my spouse on every little thing and can't live or breathe without their permission, right? That's unhealthy. We don't want that. We want this interdependence together. And this has really changed a lot of how we relate for the better, trying to avoid autonomy here. All right. Joey's going to tackle this one.
So, yeah, on the one hand, we want our spouse to share with us, but what if they're being really negative? You know, they're going through a difficult time. Maybe they're grieving or something. Maybe they're just being a really cynical butthead for a point in time or something like that. How should we respond? What do we do? First of all, acknowledge the difficulty. That's very simple to do. Even if you don't fully understand the situation yet, just show them that you get that that's hard. And learn to keep yourself calm. If we shut down every time our spouse talks to us about something that they're going through that's hard, you know, that's one thing. But sometimes to show that we really care, we try to outdo their own intensity, and that's not really helpful either. So learn to stay calm and just acknowledge the difficulty. And then demonstrate your understanding. Use exploratory statements and open-ended questions to try to get a better understanding of what they're going through and what they're feeling. Try not to ask why. It's not because why is a bad word, but it's because why questions sometimes come off as accusatory. And when we're already in a heightened emotional state and someone's asking, why are you doing that? That comes off as just really sharp and cutting, could cause a fight. So we want to ask them to explain more to us, ask questions that will help them explain more and get them to talk more. Keep them open-ended. And also, this is really helpful, listen out for metaphors and for simile. This can give us some insight to how they might be feeling, and it can help us to maybe articulate what they're going through a little bit more. All right, so if our spouse comes in, for example, and says, I hate my job, I swear, I'm quitting tomorrow, I'm tired of feeling like a hamster on a wheel. I mean, obviously it would do no good to say, what are you out of your mind? We're not in a financial situation where you could just make a career switch right now. Why would you even say something like that? But pointing out a hamster on a wheel, tell me more about that. What do you mean? And see what they say. The fact is, there are going to be times where we need to learn to be the first responder in our spouse's life. And so when we think about first responders, why don't architects and city planners get invited to like live fire scenes? It's because it's not really helpful to have someone going around saying like, well, I guess this would be a good opportunity to fix those light fixtures, maybe do something about this external landscaping. The fire's got to be put out first before we talk about all that. So we want to listen and make sure that we can understand what they're saying before we start firing our counsel at them, before we start handing them our advice. When we're in this heightened and even hostile emotional state, you might not be ready for input right then and there. It's really hard to receive input when you feel like someone doesn't understand what you're talking about. That actually feels disrespectful. This is how we wind up in a fight and we're like, we don't even know how we got there. It was like someone hit the fast forward button and we're like, why are we fighting? What happened? So these are good things to keep in mind. We also want to make our time together count. Different times of our lives, there's going to be circumstances that come up where we don't get as much time as we would like. So it's important to make that time count. All right? So just remember that 2 hours of talking together is better than 4 hours of Netflix together. I'm not saying Netflix is bad or something. If you want to watch season 3 of Stranger Things, you know, go do that together. But my point is, engaging and making our time count can help when we're going through a period where we feel like we're not getting as much time as we would like for whatever reason. If necessary, it can be good to allot separate times for like recharging and just kind of having fun, and then other times to have more substantial discussions. We did this at one point. It was recommended to us. We kept our date night. That's just going to be fun and relaxing. We're going to build each other up and just have a good time and relax. But then other times during the week, another time, we're going to talk about heavier stuff. We're going to talk about the finances and the difficult decisions and the difficult ministry situation, whatever it is. But as time has gone on, it's actually become less necessary to dichotomize those two things. It's just like once we kind of got in sync with each other and did that, it became less important. But this can be a really helpful thing if you find that you're kind of stressing each other out and you can't figure out why. Gottman talks about these things he calls the six magic hours. These are patterns he saw in couples who he felt like were really implementing a lot of the stuff in his books really well. It amounted up to about 6 hours per week engaged with this sort of thing. Partings for 2 minutes a day. That means before you leave in the morning, saying goodbye, saying you love each other. Some kind of contact before you go to work. And then reunions, when you get home, catching up on your day, you know, spending a little bit of time just talking about how things are going. One thing that was funny is Gottman recommended getting a big, fat, 6-second kiss the minute that your spouse walks in the door. Yeah, I guess that's nice, but yeah. Appreciation. 5 minutes a day of basically encouraging one another and saying thank you to one another for different things. Affection, also 5 minutes a day. You know, 5 minutes a day of some kind of physical interaction, like just cuddling together, a hug, something like that. 2 hours a week of a date night. It's not that the whole date is only 2 hours long. He's talking about 2 hours of engaged conversation. 2 hours of good conversation. And then what he calls the state of the union for 1 hour a week, which is an hour a week talking about your marriage. Talking about things going on, talking about things that you want to do together, talking about things in your life, stuff like that. Talking about the marriage itself. Now, I don't think the takeaway here is to start legalistically applying all these things to your marriage and getting really down on your spouse if they don't hold up their end of the bargain. It's not like, oh, we only got 2.5 minutes of affection today and you got to pull each other aside at home church and start making out together or something like that. It's not the point. I think the real takeaway is how easy these things can be to ignore. These are such small things, they don't seem like they amount to very much, and yet we come through times where we feel like we're just sort of living past each other and we're not really in contact anymore. And these are really simple ways that we can do that, because when we stay connected and tuned in like this, it opens the door for us to share more substantial things with one another. And this is vital when it comes to that idea of shared meaning that Gottman was talking about. We need to have a category for sharing and supporting one another's goals and our convictions and developing a vision for what our marriage is going to look like and what we are going to pursue together. That's so vital and brings so much strength to our marriage. And a lot of negativity can come from feeling like our spouse doesn't care about these things. So it's important for us to be vocalizing them, and it's also important for us to listen to our spouse's goals and convictions, and to have a category for talking about that consistently, right? These types of things might overlap, but they don't necessarily have to. If you have a strength in an area where your spouse really wants to improve, it doesn't mean that you need to adopt their improvement plan. It could mean, though, that your strength in this area, you're going to help them out with that. Maybe you're gifted in that area. Or you just have more experience there. And so you're still going to be supportive, even though you're not going to necessarily do the same things. It's good to keep in mind, too, that when it comes to the picture in our head of what we want our life to be like, what we want to pursue for God, sometimes these are born out of pain and struggle and fear, which is strange. But sometimes the things we want can come from like these fears like that. And so we can really be a big help to each other to reframe these things positively and create a real positive vision for our future together that can evolve and take shape more and more over time as we continue to actively pursue God together. So if your spouse says something like, I never want to be a disengaged leader. Yeah, that'd be a drag. But just trying to avoid being disengaged is not a very victorious way to live. And you wouldn't want your spouse to be wrapped up in that all the time. So you could say something like, me neither. Well, what are some qualities we see in radically engaged leaders? What do they do that keeps them engaged? What are some areas where we're already pretty strong in this? Where do you think we could do better? And having a more positive discussion so that you're victoriously pursuing something rather than just living for things that you both want to avoid. I know for us, you know, pretty early on in our marriage, about a year into our marriage, we were both having just this period of like some frustration in ministry and stuff like that, and we were discussing it together. And it really seemed like the Spirit just kind of directed the conversation over to the area of let's get the focus off of the types of leaders we don't want to be and talk about the types of leaders that we do want to be. And from that discussion, that just painted this portrait in our minds that was so cool, that had a big influence on the ways we made decisions in every area of our life, the things that we really decided were really important to do together, and that led to a lot of the insights we've brought forth to you guys today. And so, yeah, this can really make a big difference when we're in tune with each other in this way. So that's all that we had. We've got some papers up here. We left you guys some exercises that you can do. These are from John Gottman's books. They're pretty fun, simple little exercises that line up with what we were talking about today. You can do them at dinner tonight. You can do them for your next date. They're pretty fun. Thanks, God, for marriage. Thanks for all the marriages we have here in our fellowship, with young people really learning to do this and really pursue this sort of thing. And we just pray that we can have a really good rest of the time here at the conference tonight. Amen. Thanks for coming, everybody.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.